Greetings in Jesus, crucified, risen, and coming. Good morning to each of you. Morning is a good time. It's a good time for me to, I like to go outside and enjoy nature, go into my garden. There was a boy who watched the sun set in the evening, and he wondered what happens to the sun. So he decided he's going to stay up. And so he sat out in the darkness for quite a long time, wondering about the sun and where it was. And then it dawned on him. Earlier this year, Wall Street Journal, according to a Professor Robert Pierce of the University of Rochester, said that corny, pun-filled jokes can be instrumental in teaching and in helping, and I quote now, forge healthy relationships between fathers and their sons and daughters. So I take comfort in that. And maybe it applies to teachers too. Those that cause my students to groan, just as my children did. Well, some of you have been wondering how old I am. So I'll let you know. But you'll have to have some mathematical and biblical knowledge to figure it out. If you think of a Bible character who was a daddy who became a mummy, he had a sister, Dinah, and 11 brothers. His father's name was Jacob. He spent quite a bit of his life in Egypt. If you count up the number of letters in his name, multiply times 4, and add 9, that is my current age. Now, you might be interested also in my classroom. There I am with in my classroom. I think wearing the same shirt that I am today. Another angle from it. Might notice an empty desk here. That is because I'm the principal of the school, as well as this year I was teaching grade 7 to 10. And so there's 3 other classes, and if there is a discipline issue that the teacher wants to send a pupil to me, then I have this, desk here where the student comes in feeling a little embarrassed, and they're younger, and the students around them are older, and they do their work there for a while, and after a while I ask them if they're ready to go back to their classroom, and listen to their teacher real well. Oh, yeah, they are. So away they go. I think if you count up the desks, you'll come to 32 in that particular class. Anyhow, school culture is my topic this morning. Accept it, yet aim to improve it. So what should we accept? I'm wondering how many of you who are teachers are teaching at a place other than your home congregation. Would you raise your hand, please? Wow. Well, over half of you are immigrants. So things are probably done differently at the school where you will be teaching or have been teaching. Thinking about going to a different school for the first time. So I'm just saying, don't feel irritated when things are done differently. Yet don't lose your vision for improving things. So there are variations in schools. For example, when children get to school, some schools have a 3-minute bell for them students to get into their desks. Some go directly to their seat, and then the teacher rings a little bell. At Fairhaven, where I teach, the students all line up after the bell rings in our basement or by our classroom, and by gender, line up straight, quietly, and then on my direction, or the teacher's direction, they move quietly to their classroom. At some schools, they're not allowed into the school until a bell goes about 10, 15 minutes before, and then they all walk in single file, I believe, and the teacher probably is there to just say good morning to each one of them individually, calling them by their name. When students leave school, there's variation also. I know of one school where there's a big circle outside, and all the students stand in that circle, and they can't do anything else except stand there until the ride comes, and that has a way of encouraging the rides to come quite quickly after school. After 10 minutes or so, then pretty well everyone is gone, and then they can move around more. And school where I teach, there's no arrangement like that. They just are expected to keep their eye open for their ride and get to it when it comes. Some teachers expect students to say good morning. The students say good morning to them when they come or into the classroom. Others, the way I grew up back in Ontario, was we all stood up at the beginning of the day, and when the teacher said good morning, boys and girls, and we would say, good morning, Mrs. Roman. That was my first and second grade teacher. Some teachers, like my daughter, teaches first and second grade. As the students leave the classroom, she says goodbye to each one, calling them by their name. There are differences as far as schedule is concerned, or keeping on schedule. Some schools have a bell system, and you have to go by those bells. The school where I teach, we have a morning bell, which I ring. But then after that, it's up to the teachers to dismiss at an appropriate time. And there can be variation as to exactly what time the class is dismissed. We have staggered recess times frequently because we're sharing playground space. So there's various things to accept as a student. Also accept differences from your previous teaching experience. I was in one school, I think it was in Pennsylvania, where they had a bathtub in the classroom. I raised my eyebrows at that a little bit, but it was an old-time bathtub with fancy, you know, those old cast-iron legs. And there was pillows in there and a bit of a canopy over top of it. And that was when the students did really well or were to be rewarded, and then they could go and sit in the bathtub and read. There was no water in there. I wanted to go and sit in that bathtub. I didn't have enough nerve to ask the teacher, and I guess I wasn't good enough. In my daughter's classroom, first and second grade, a couple years ago, I guess she had a tent set up and a castle, something she had picked up at a garage sale, I think. And so that was special for the young children to go in there and read or whatever they were assigned to do. Also, accept the expectations of the board and of the school community, the standards. I teach in a Beachy Amish school, and so I and the students wear solid colors, clothing, and the boys and myself do not wear bill caps. They have not expected me to wear a beard. But there are various differences, slight differences, from my home congregation and the congregation that I teach for. And, of course, I think it's important for teachers to urge their students, especially as they get older and become church members, to follow the expectations, the standards of the church. So what to accept? A couple other things. Accept the things you should not change. Change the things that can be improved and have the wisdom to know the difference. I think I see a plaque on the wall in some houses, something like that, but it's a little different than that. So accept it and yet seek to improve it. It's not enjoyable to be in a rut, to be stagnant in a school. Yet, I think it's important that we humbly realize that there may be good reasons why there are aspects of the culture that are the way they are, and we might think it would be better to do something different. And sometimes it's a matter of behavior that's just acceptable, or it's always been that way, cliques and that sort of thing. Here is a person who is learning to become a teacher, and she writes, "I was blessed to be taught in a Christian day school. All my teachers impacted who I am today, but there's one teacher who has really stood out in my life. Perhaps she made such an impact because she taught me at such an important time in my life, the period of time when you realize the seriousness of life, how big God is, and accountability. Grade 6 brings so many changes and difficulties as you mature, and oh, the many issues girls have at that age with relationships. One particular day went like this. Half the girls weren't on speaking terms. A few here and there were giving each other, if looks could kill, kind of glances. And a few were in tears. I don't remember which I was. Our poor teacher took one look at the mess. When she entered the classroom, this all happened before class, and she took action. She gathered all us girls into a room and had a prayer. The prayer is what has stuck with me. I guess you could say it was my first grown-up girl prayer. We stood in a circle with our arms around each other, and she prayed. She poured out her heart to God over our seemingly pointless girl drama. She cared so much. Tears rolled down her cheeks. It wasn't that I'd never heard anyone pray for me before, but it was then that I really realized the importance of gathering with other people and praying honestly. To this day, I still love the prayer, the power and strength I received from group prayer." So the teacher went about to change something that seemed to have been established there. And be content with the things that are unchangeable. And be cautious, be gentle. I would say be incremental with improvements as you are new to the place. Not too abruptly, not too arrogantly, even if you are an experienced teacher coming to a new school. A teacher can quickly lose the confidence of the school board and of the parents by just assuming things rather than asking. I know I've heard some teachers say, "Well, I think we'll ask the school board and see what they say. Maybe they'll consent to this idea." I have preferred a different approach. I can only think of one time that I asked for something from the school board that they said, "No, I don't think so," after they had considered it. Because I sort of have a feel for the community and the culture there. And it's not that we haven't made a lot of changes, but I don't like to push the envelope. Let's think about some areas now of acceptance. Music being one of them. Songbooks, maybe you only have Praises We Sing and you'd like to have some other book. Well, maybe you can. But maybe you can supplement the song repertoire by songs that you introduce that are not in a book. One teacher I know gives a songbook, a hardcover, big songbook, every year to his class at Christmas time, and then they use that book for the rest of the year. Talking about introducing new songs, I sang a new song with you, new for many of you yesterday. So it's time for a review. Would you stand up? And let's sing God is a Good God. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. He will lift you up, he will turn you around. He will set your feet on solid ground. He will lift you up, he will turn you around. He will set your feet on solid ground. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. God is a good God, oh yes he is. Thank you. You may be seated. Well, wonderful singing at this place, and you're quick to pick things up. Well, when I came to my present school, what did I say, 37 years ago? 38 years ago? They had a hymn book that they used at church and at school called the Christian Hymnal. Not my favorite hymnal, but it's okay. I like many of the songs in it. But many of the songs were unknown to the school community and to the children. And so I got this idea that I'd like to sing through the hymn book, starting with number one. And so I invited the parents and song leaders, whoever wanted to come and learn songs. So we went through about 40 or 50 songs in an hour and a half or so. If everyone knew the song, we just sang one verse. If they knew more than that, if they didn't know any, then we usually would sing all the verses so they'd get familiar with them. So that took a few years to get through the 650 songs in that book. But about that time, Zion's Praises was coming into vogue. And so we've been singing through that. We're getting close to number 700 now, I think. We got a few more years to go with that one yet. Over 800 page songs in that. So if we continue the pattern, it'll probably be songs, Hymns of the Church, the Purple Martin book, you know. But I'll be pushing 100 by the time we get through that one, I think, with over 1,000 songs. Well, that's part of the culture. Abilities? Well, school communities vary in their abilities, as do individual students vary. Be careful how you deal with monotone singers. As they get older, they probably realize that they're not exactly on key, and so they soften. That's not so much with second graders. Yet, we can strive to improve the attitudes toward singing and as well as the abilities. Now, when I arrived at Fairhaven School and I led a song, if I stopped singing, the singing stopped. It was very weak and uncertain. I taught grades 4 and up those first years. And so, with my wife's help, we introduced alto. And so there was one girl that could handle that second part. And then, gradually, we introduced tenor and bass, especially as we grade 9 and 10 became more common. And yet, for the first 8 years or so, the singing was rather Well, let's say the quality was pathetic. The words were good. And some of the attitudes were good. However, I heard of other songs, other schools where the older boys liked to sing. I thought, wow, that would be something to teach older boys who like to sing. And then I had five boys in eighth grade, and they were able to sing. Four out of the five were pretty good singers. And they sort of liked singing, and they wondered if they could, maybe I had tried it a little bit, but they got enthused about trying to do some male voice singing. Quartet, it was actually a quintet. We called it the Fairhaven Five. And so, about once a week in the evening for a couple hours, my wife and I would go to the school, which is about a little over 20 miles away. And we would work with these boys. Their parents would bring them in and listen or do something else. And they got to be fairly good with some relatively easy male voice songs. And so we made a recording, which was, I would say, maybe a notch below Oasis singing. But, they did pretty well. And these were the boys that could hit the baseball the farthest. They loved to play hockey. They were really skilled at sports. And so the younger boys, they looked up to these older boys. And, oh, it's all right to sing. Enjoy singing. And be enthused about singing. So that's now about 30 years ago. And with a few exceptions of individuals who don't care for singing, the my boys, the whole class, do like to sing. And on this picture here, you see, last year I had fewer students, and so we could easily pack them into a couple vans. And we went to sing. This is at a nursing home there in Ontario. And we did a number of programs in churches as well as in nursing homes. And I just got them up there to the front. And this was, I think, Psalm 23 at a chapel service. Minister at a local nursing home were open to us coming. So I thought, well, instead of me doing it, as I often do in the summertime, I'll have it during the year. And so the boys, there were six of them, they each expounded briefly on a verse from Psalm 23, and they blew the pitch pipe and they did the singing, and it was a good experience for them and for those who listened. Let's think next about homework. There's some things to accept here on the part of parents and on the part of teachers. My first point is that parents need to accept the fact that there are benefits to homework. And here's about six or so that I thought of. If you need to convince the board or parents of some validity for some homework at least. First of all, homework links the home and the school. So as parents glance over the shoulder of their child at the kitchen table, they can keep in touch. At least it affords a good opportunity for parents to give words of praise for neat work, or show interest in a unit on science, or a reprimand for careless math. Homework also helps slower students to keep up. Some students have slower work habits. Some have difficulty understanding, and so they're slowed down in their work. Others dawdle and spend some time counting the flies in the classroom ceiling, things like that. So then homework helps them to keep up. Homework expands the learning time. Hardly enough time in school for mastering the basics, much less those extra things that enrich a student's educational experience. Homework provides a place for special projects to be done. Some children, for example, have difficulty memorizing in a classroom, but they can say it aloud at home. Also, things like projects involving hammering and sawing and building are more expedient at home than they are in the classroom. Homework provides opportunities for self-discipline, so they can decide if they're going to do it right after school when they get home, or later on in the evening, or early the next morning, or not do it at all and hope for the best when they get to school. And homework can encourage ongoing study, because they're used to studying at home, and so after graduation they can continue to do that. Now, quite a bit of the homework that is done by my students is optional. They choose to do it, or they choose not to do it. For example, over the years, every 4 years has been the practice, because I teach grades, have taught grades 7 to 10 frequently. So every student has the opportunity to join in the Great Memory Work Contest. So what this is, a minimum amount of memory work that they need to learn is 300 verses. Got this idea from some teachers, I think, in Pennsylvania. Some student had learned 600 verses, and I thought, oh, don't think my students could do that. You know, 100 or 200 is pretty good. So I thought, we'll try 300, and 100 I'll assign, 100 they'll choose, and 100 they can choose that they haven't learned before. So that makes a total of 300. They have to say it in groups of verses, 1 month apart. They have to say it twice, so they can't just cram it and then forget it, sort of thing. So the first year, most of the students did, and I took them by train to Toronto and rode the subway and, I don't know, went up the CN Tower or something, sort of like the Seattle Space Needle. And over the years now, they've increased their aspirations, so that if they are able to learn 600 verses, then I've taken them to the capital city of Canada, which is not Washington. And so we're overnight there, a night or two. And if they get to, well, this last year, 2 years ago, I'd never seen anything like it before in my class, but some got quite enthused about learning memory work. They would set their alarm clock for 6 o'clock in the morning, and they'd study for an hour and work some more in the evening. And so I had, I think, 15 out of 32 who learned approximately 1,200 verses. So there we did go to the capital city of the United States. Have some cheap museums down there along the mall. And then I had 5, most of them boys, that learned over 1,700. And I've sort of, it's not intended to be competitive at all, but I think they sort of, they're pretty quiet about how many verses they've learned. We keep track of it on the paper. And but they also know what their previous older siblings have done. And so that's how you get things like 1,201 verses learned. So there were 2 boys, grade 8 boys, who, forget now, was it 2,150? 2,150 verses that they had learned. So to hear them go down through a chapter in the Bible is, well, I didn't listen to most of it. I had parents come in and or other people from the community, and I'd often have 3 people listening to memory work pretty well every day of the week for about the last 3/4 of an hour. So that's what I mean by optional. They don't have to do any of that. They have to learn the 100 verses that I assigned. So, having said that, homework, I think, has its benefits. a lot of the homework that my students would have would be studying for tests or finishing up projects or catching up in their work. However, students are expected to work hard during the day. Now, on the point of teachers, they need to accept the fact that homework needs to be reasonable. And students have a variety of opinions about what is reasonable. For one thing, parents have activities for their children at home. Children need a break. From school activities for good attitudes towards school and so on, and just a break for their minds. Some parents look at it like this. If I can find this quotation. When at school, my child should do schoolwork. After school is dismissed for the day, I don't want homework interfering with any plans I have for the children. So if that's the prevailing attitude in the community, then that's something that you have to live with. Maybe gradually change. Sometimes, some years, I say we'll have homework every Monday night, so they can count on assigned homework every Monday night. And try to be sensitive if there's revival meetings or a church service about homework. Ideally, there'll be an understanding, having a balanced approach to homework on the part of teachers and parents. If you are teaching at a school where there's no homework, very little, then you as a teacher need to adjust your expectations and accept the culture. Well, let's think a little bit about curriculum next. Teachers have various opinions, and there's a wide variety, no doubt, of curriculum, or curricula, or curriculums, or whatever it is. Teachers need to work with the approach that's taken, whether it's individualized or classroom or some hybrid, the style of teaching. If you don't like the classroom approach, then you don't need to accept an assignment in a school that has the classroom approach, and vice versa. If it's individualized but you see a lot of advantages to classroom approach, then you can sort of do the hybrid thing and include lessons with the whole class as much as possible, things like devotions and art and music and writing and things like that. Teachers need to accept the textbooks and the workbooks that are provided by the school. Maybe you're used to a different textbook, or you prefer a different publisher. Accept the culture that way. And students and parents need to accept the teaching approach. You know, some of us are more lecture-oriented. Some of us really thrive on discussion. Some of us more question and answer, orally or written. Teachers have different styles. And the amount of grading. Now, I'm a Canadian. I've been indoctrinated in Canadian ways of grading, and we in Canada, at least in Ontario, tend to do a lot less grading and marking of papers than my American friends tend to do. But I know some American schools say every paper that's written by, every assignment needs to be graded by the teacher. That's sort of the board mandate. Well, I'd rather spend an hour in preparation rather than marking and marking and marking and marking after school. So, especially in the older grades at our school, a lot of the marking of answers is done by students, either each other or their own, as the case might be. And this may sound like pedagogical heresy, but it seems to work with us, or the teachers think it does, and I think the board is fine with it too. So I do a lot of classroom instruction with students at the blackboard. I'm blessed with six large chalkboards, and so I can get at least 12 students, and that's typically what I have in a class, about that size. Sometimes a few more, a few less. And so we do a lot of work there, and so I pretty well know on a day-to-day basis where a student is having difficulty. And so when I give a test, which is about once a month, I rarely get a surprise as to how the student is going to be doing, because I've been keeping track of their, because we work at the blackboard a lot, something like many teachers would have as they grade the papers each day. So it's a bit of a shortcut, trying to be efficient with time in the classroom, both for the students and for myself. Some things, of course, I have to grade, compositions and things like that. But a lot of marking is done together in class. And even our first and second grade teacher trains the students to grade their own work, to mark their own work right or wrong, or other, if they exchange papers, that sort of thing. Then there are schools also who, in which the teacher needs to, it's sort of a current fad in my opinion, to write out detailed lesson plans. So in some schools, every lesson has to be written out in detail in the planning stage, and then needs to be approved by a supervising teacher. And that's not my style at all, but I'd have difficulty functioning in that culture. But that's the way it is in some places, and so you have to work with whatever the culture is and accept it. Let's think next about involvement of parents. Now, some parents are, or grandparents are very much involved in school life. And there are things that seniors in the congregation or grandparents can do, as well as parents. They can drill flashcards, for example, math and vocabulary words. They can listen to reading. It takes much teacher time to listen to students read, and takes a lot of student time as well. So I know of one lady from our congregation comes in and listens to reading for several hours a week. There's tutoring to be done, especially in math and reading, one-on-one instruction and remedial work. Listen to memory work, as I mentioned earlier today. Supervising at recess. This can provide time for the teacher to give a little extra help to a struggling student. And I think somebody needs to be outside supervising the students pretty well all the time. Having an art lesson or a craft. The picture here shows candle making at our school with a parent teaching him how to do that. And of course, many fathers and others in the congregation come in for devotions. And for us, it's Wednesdays that we do that. Then there are also special classes this last year. It was the year for the boys to learn about small engines, and we weren't able to find someone to teach that. The year before, we had welding and plumbing, and this next year, I think we're going to have small engines. I think that's arranged. So I got the idea, what could we have for the boys? The girls were doing home economics pretty well every week for most of an afternoon, so I thought, it would be a useful skill for boys to learn how to cook. So a couple of mothers were ready to engage in this for the equivalent of about 8 afternoons or something like that. And so the boys were a little hesitant at first, but they really did enjoy it then. They decided they'd like to make pies. So there's the end product there. And they were pretty tasty. And they wanted to make a special meal then for myself and for the girls. And so they made it pretty nice. And there are the 6 chefs that were working at this project. And that's just a picture of a special class that we have, a little barn on the adjoining property. And so here these fellows were soldering their copper pipes, and then they joined them all together and then turned on the water and see who got sprayed. There's always a couple that do. And there are also electives that can be done. It can be motivating for students, especially in February, that sort of thing. The doldrums might hit, but some schools have a formal elective program where for 6 weeks or so, a student gets to choose out of 5 or 10 different things, and the parents come in, and they might learn about photography or leather work or cooking or candles or chess or whatever the case might be. Anyway, a little more on the subject of motivation. What works and what is acceptable or unacceptable from the standpoint of the community, particularly the school board? Stories and current events, I think they're pretty well acceptable any place. Here's one about a Russian woman who went to Switzerland and ended up paying $7,700 for a coffee and a piece of cake. She accidentally entered her PIN code, 7687, as the tip on the credit card machine. So take warning here, folks. And when she got her bank statement, she realized she had been charged about $8,000 tip, which is fairly generous by most people's standards, I think. She asked the credit card company to cancel the charge, but it couldn't help because the payment wasn't fraudulent. So she contacted the cafe owner, who promised to return the money, but turned out the cafe owner had gone out of business, and so she never got that money back. Here's another thing earlier this year. A girl, she 10 years old from Maryland, she won a national handwriting competition. This girl was born without hands, and so she grips the pencil between her arms and creates beautiful penmanship. Here's another account about two months ago. Anyway, the two girls, 9 years old they were eating in a school cafeteria. And the one girl was obviously choking and turning blue, and her friend, who knew something about the Heimlich maneuver, started putting pressure there on the abdomen and dislodged a piece of hot dog. Wieners are one of the worst things for choking with children. I sort of choke on some too for that matter, but for a different reason, depending on the variety, I guess. And competition has, there are some pros and cons to competition. And I use it a fair bit in my class. Students get involved, they're excited about it, motivation is high, they're trying hard, they like games. There's the enjoyment of working together as it's a sort of one team of students against another team in a geography contest or history review, a lot of geography sort of thing. There's suspense as to what type of question I'm going to ask or what the question will be and who will get it. It's fairly versatile. You can use it in many different kinds of subjects. It doesn't have to be long. A little competitive thing, a little game, about 5 minutes of it can breathe new life into a stale lesson. At the same time, there may be a competitive spirit that develops. There could be pride or jealousy or clamor. Some students may feel bad. So I think it's wise to be careful with competition. But tough for me to imagine a satisfying volleyball game or basketball game where there's no competition at all. You just toss the ball and see what happens to it. And sometimes it goes through the hoop. Well, if it does, fine. If it doesn't, so who cares? And we're just playing a game of non-competitive basketball. However, I think we should guard against the abuse of competition. We can adjust the difficulty. So if I have a student that I know is going to, maybe it's around the world or whatever you call it, or two students stand beside each other and whichever one gets the right answer moves on to the next one. You see how many places they can move. So if I have a weaker student, then I might throw a question like this. Instead of 7 times 8, I might say 8 times 0. And there's a good chance that the one who doesn't know the math facts as well will be able to get that one. So you can adjust the difficulty. You can also vary the teams, and that helps to keep it from being a competitive thing, that tone. And you can be ready to terminate. Oh, that's bell. Yeah, that means terminate pretty soon. If things get slightly out of hand, you can adjust the expectations as well. So if I've got one team with 8 points and another one has only 1, then I might say, okay, the last question here is a special question. It's a 10-pointer. So then either team can equally has an equal chance. Keep a sort of a fun atmosphere, not too serious about all this. It's just a means of learning. And, of course, squelch boasting or anything that resembles a superior air. But it can be used in many different subjects. Yes, accept the culture, and yet look for ways to improve it.